Speed Demon?
Yeah, this movie's called Speed Demon. I don't want to offend the guy that this is a... He somehow got into ACT, but this one that I saw was at Blockbusters called Speed Demon, and the whole premise is this guy, who's not wearing a shirt, comes back to his hometown and sees all his old buddies who are all not wearing shirts, and they basically...
Is that sort of like part of, like, to identify that they're from the same town, they just don't wear shirts?
No,
like
just
no,
nobody
something?
Wears shirts. Okay. Nobody wears shirts whatsoever. And he... meets the, you know, the sister of some girl. And
okay,
falls in love
also
with
not wearing a shirt?
No, she's wearing a shirt, actually. Oh. And interestingly, they have
You almost had me there until that.
They actually have a sex scene, and I mean, they're kind of halfway under covers, but it's the most, like, basically the whole sex scene is, it's the movie's rated R, first of all. It has no foul language in it, and the sex scene is them basically at arm lengths away while he kind of kisses her neck a little bit, and she's wearing, like clothes. That's the sex scene. And
pretty tame by today's standards.
Yeah, extremely. Yeah, and it was made today. I mean,
it was like a heavy petting scene, maybe.
Exactly. So this whole movie is basically it's pretty close to gay porn. Premise: guys who race their cars locally,
kind of like Fast and the Furious, sort of.
Exactly. Except for there's a speed demon that they unleash to give them
a literal speed demon.
A literal speed demon. That's the best thing about the title is that it's literal.
Easy to understand. Yeah. High concept, as
they
say.
The way they bring this thing about to help them win these big races against rival street gangs of, you know, guys who race their cars, is that they get down into their underwear. And they pour blood and then smear them over their naked, sculpted, rock-hard bodies. And the whole movie, I kid you not, 95% of it is men smearing blood on each other.
So, like set up in creative montage sequences?
Yeah. There's lots of dissolves and you know, creepy music playing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
so
really...
they're all like following the demon. So like guys are in competition and they both pray to the same speed demon.
No, it's just this one gang that he comes back and kind of fights to get into. And there's, you know, of course there's an antagonist in the gang who doesn't want him to. And that guy ends up taking over the gang and there's something like that. And then they end up you know, having a street race near the end of it and somebody dies. The point is they smear blood on each other's mostly naked bodies.
That
the whole
is time. Clearly the
that,
point.
That was almost the whole movie. And so my wife runs into this guy and she says, you know, I saw your movie. And he's like, oh my gosh, don't tell me that other people have seen this. I don't want anyone to see this movie. This is
at least he understands.
Oh, you know, he knew. He knew absolutely.
Well, it's part of the game, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and actually, I think since then he did three films. The third one he did was one I don't even think it was a comedy, just a romantic thing where this guy kind of has to try to win this girl and her, against her neighbor's very strict, her parents', you know, wishes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I getcha. Well, that one doesn't sound so bad. It's not like he was kind of getting out of that. I mean, hell, even Jennifer Aniston did Leprechaun. I mean, you gotta start somewhere.
Did she do the one in space or another one?
No, she just did the first one.
She was in the first one?
She's got that as bragging.
Was she only in one? Or was she in more?
Well, she was only in one, yeah. And there was never any callback to her. I don't think there was a hell of a lot of continuity between any of the Leprechauns. And I've searched to try and discover it. Because if you think about it, you've got the first
one. Well, there's the Leprechaun.
There's Warwick Davis. I believe he has played the Leprechaun through.
What else is he going to do?
Like Willow the Next Generation?
Yeah.
Good point.
Wicket. There's no need for Wicket
The Adventures of Wicket. It could be like some kind of series.
On Broadway. Coming soon to Broadway.
Or like a Meet the Press with Wicket, let's say, you know, and he's just like sitting there like, nom nom, and they're like, I don't really know what to say. Okay, so you got Leprechaun 1, which is pretty solid and makes some sense, and it's funny, and this can kind of get into the whole, like, is it funny or is it just stupid rule? Leprechaun 1 plays as funny because it tries to be scary. It winks at the audience a few times, like, yeah, we get this. But it's not as bad as it gets by, like, the third or the fourth one, where that's entirely what it's about. It's just all about this camp humor,
right,
which it doesn't play when you're trying to be funny, because we have to laugh at you. We can't laugh with you, because then we just feel like we're being stupid. So, but though that said, I have not seen the fifth and 5A Leprechaun movies. Which
5A?
Well, there was Leprechaun... In the Hood.
I saw that one. That was actually the first one I saw.
That was Leprechaun 5.
Right. I thought that was 4. What was 4?
4 was in space.
So 4 was in space.
And set in the future. Far
so they did
the
3
future.
Before they even had to go to the gimmicks of going to space or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. 3 was in Vegas. That was the gimmick of being in Vegas.
Okay, all right.
But 4 is in space and way into far into the future. There's all this, like aliens and political
politics.
There's a little bit of that, right. Yeah. he kidnaps this princess and everything. But then the fifth one, they're back in the hood, and it's in modern times, so it's like either he falls, the chunks of him, because he gets enlarged through this ray in the fourth one at the end, and then gets, you know, decompressed and out into space, but it's like pieces are still animated, because you can tell, because like his giant floating leprechaun hand gives them the finger.
The finger, of course. That's what leprechauns are known to do.
Must get sucked into a wormhole and reconstituted, and then put into like Compton or wherever he ends up. In modern times, so there's Leprechaun 5, which I haven't seen.
It was actually, they found him in a tread.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but then the thing is, then there's Leprechaun back into the hood.
Oh.
Which is like the 5A.
So 5A, I get it. Yeah.
Or I don't know what to call it.
It's a sequel of the new Leprechaun in the Hood series.
It's not the second of the new. It could be believable, like with Batman, that maybe they're trying to restart the Leprechaun franchise.
Sure.
Or like, I guess they're doing that with Star Trek now. I just read about that.
Yeah.
Which
J.J. Abrams, I think.
Yeah, J.J. Abrams is going to direct it. They might have Matt Damon as Kirk and everything.
Of course,
it could play interesting, but I kind of think that the Star Trek stuff is so loaded with Trek stuff, and they've done so much work to create a continuous universe that they should just sort of abandon that and go with their own sci-fi world, you know?
Which they might end up doing, like, for instance, with, was it Call the Conqueror? Which was supposed to be, that was originally a Conan story.
It was supposed to be a Conan story, huh?
And what they did was they couldn't get the... It was Kevin Sorbo said that he did not want to try to recreate the role that Arnold did, because apparently Arnold did a fantastic job
and he did an indelible.
They broke the mold when Arnold was Conan.
He was the quintessential barbarian.
Fantastic acting, and so he basically said, "I want to play another character." So they went to another character that guy who created Conan. I forget his name. He killed himself.
I don't remember his name, but they did a movie with Vincent D'Onofrio that was about him playing that character that was creating Conan.
But I thought it was interesting that they tried to do with that, but it ended up being. Extremely unpopular because the people didn't realize this was supposed to be Conan, but just with a different name.
That's too bad that they did that.
And the same thing with Red Sonja. Have you seen Red Sonja?
Yeah, I've had.
So basically, they filmed that wanting it to be Conan again, but and he was all for it. Schwarzenegger was all for it.
He was in it, obviously.
Yeah, he was all for it. He was basically, but right before they started shooting, the producer said, you know, we don't want to mess up the Conan continuity.
That's a good point.
Because it was so important to them. Yeah, the second movie was awful. I just watched it again the other day.
Conan the Destroyer?
Yeah, it was just... That's horrendous.
It's got a wizard in it, though.
It has a wizard, and it's got this scene where he fights this thing that looks like a bear who has feces all over it.
That's the wizard monster.
Yeah, the wizard monster. And, oh my gosh, it's just awful.
It's got Wilt Chamberlain, Wilt the Stilt.
And he's...
As Bombara?
He was a little bit better than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was in the whatever Bruce Lee movie he
was in. Oh, Game of Death?
Yeah.
That was I actually like
those basketball players are pretty wooden in movies like that. I never saw He's Got Game. You ever see that one, the Spike Lee movie?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, Ray Allen plays this guy named Jesus Shuttleworth, who's some up and coming blue chipper, and he's has to face his demons. And Denzel plays his dad, and he's got a big fro in it. That's all I remember.
You just remember the Denzel fro.
Anyway, getting back to the Leprechaun thing.
Yeah.
What introduced me to the whole series was I saw a Leprechaun in the Hood first. And I was thinking, I thought it was going to be totally different. It was, first of all, every time there was anything that was going to be remotely violent, they cut away.
Oh, they're doing that whole trying to, just like Alien versus Predator, where it's like, show the blood splatter on the wall.
Yeah, why not show something piercing someone or something? That's what I wanted to see.
Was it PG-13?
It was R.
They probably threw in the obligatory tit scene and stuff.
There might have been, probably really fake. But, filthy language all the way through.
That's ridiculous.
I don't know. It really disappointed me, mostly because I didn't realize that the whole series was about a rhyming leprechaun. It's not just a leprechaun. It's a rhyming leprechaun.
Oh, well, he would do that from the very first one.
I know, and I didn't know that.
It's about, limericks and stuff.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
You know, he'd have his little whimsical line. And does he even mention in the first one? Because they established this whole thing about how he's got kind of an obsessive-compulsive disorder about shoes and making sure they're shine.
Right.
He's like, I'm a cobbler by trade.
Yeah, you throw shoes at him, he has to stop and wipe them down. They get away from him a few times in that movie by throwing shoes at him.
Okay, well, then they're going back to the old, going back to the well on that one. Because that was
tried and true, crowd pleasers about the Leprechaun series. Where's the shoes? People sit in the theater. They even go to the theaters anymore? I doubt it.
I don't think the Leprechaun movies have gone to the theaters since this. I don't know if the second one came out in theaters, but I doubt it.
I think we've spent far too much time talking about
way
Leprechaun.
Too much time.
What's
talking
the
about
what's the last movie you saw in the theater?
I saw. Let's see. I went to see. The Good Shepherd.
Oh, how was that?
It was all right. It was a time when there really wasn't very many good movies out, but that was like an excuse to go see the movies with somebody. So I went ahead and just did that.
Was it long? I heard it was very long.
Kind of, yeah, I played. Yeah, it was pretty long and kind of, I don't know, kind of somber and kind of quiet. And I saw the Charlie Rose interview with De Niro and like Angelina Jolie, who really doesn't have much of a role in that, though she is kind of the comic relief in a weird way because she kind of becomes this sort of wife that gets abandoned and right. You know, just sort of becomes a drunk. And Matt Damon, and apparently it's like he wants to do another one because it's sort of like the first level of the CIA, but then it's like the second level.
Right.
And I mean, and I don't have a problem with movies like this. I kind of like these sort of historical fictions. The only problem I have is like it was marketed as like the untold set tale of the CIA. Right. Anytime someone is doing a narrative and pretending that like there's truth in this. I mean, sure, maybe there's aspects of it, but especially when they're trying to like, if it's like a historical movie. You just stay away from that, you know? You're not doing a documentary about the CIA. This character isn't even a real character. He's not representing a real person. He's kind of representing the idea of a certain kind of guy or an amalgamation right. of those.
Was it sufficiently anti-American, as any film should be these days?
Yeah. No, I would say that it kind of wasn't because it's the early part, and so you're talking about the OSS during right. World War II.
Sure.
I mean, it was about, you know, sacrifice and stuff like that, where it's like, you know, you're going to have to do some bad things to people in order to, you know, get this figured out. And it was Cold War stuff, so there was some interesting sort of interplay, counterplay there. I mean, there was an interesting Matt Damon was pretty cool in it. I mean, he really had to play kind of a subtle, kind of quiet type that was very subdued. I mean, he'd build the ships in the bottle, and then he would kind of oversee these things that required, I don't know, like a certain degree of trust, but at the same time a complete degree of utter distrust, all on my part. But there really wasn't anything else playing there. I could have gone to see Blood Diamonds, but I really didn't feel like that kind of movie. I don't think I ever feel like that kind of movie.
The only thing I'm really planning on seeing in the near future is I wanted to see Reno 911 Miami, but I couldn't bring myself to pay full price for it, because every time my wife mentioned going to see it because she knew I wanted to, it was always at night, so I've put off seeing it. So I think the next thing I'm going to watch is probably 300.
Yeah, I like the idea of 300 because it just looks really cool, and it's got that Nine Inch Nails song from The Fragile, which is actually not the newest album, which is almost 2 years old, but actually like an 8-year-old album, which in the trailer. And so basically they kind of won me over with that, but it does look like if you're looking for content, it's kind of lacking. Like it's like just one guy yelling a whole bunch and then a bunch of
right.
crazy fight scenes.
Well, I recently read the Frank Miller graphic novel.
Yeah, I have those, and I want to look those over at some point.
Yeah, I read that it pretty much follows the Sin City movie format, which is they tried to take it pretty much not panel for panel, but the story is set up so that it would actually pretty much fit into a 2-hour movie or whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it's like five comic issues.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
so.
and they set it up the way he has it now is the way he originally intended it, which is it's on full, like basically double comic page pages, and it's in a hardcover book.
Oh wow!
And, yeah, that's the way I found it at Borders, and it seems like the reviews I read so far, it was for a while it was all on if you go to like RottenTomatoes.com
yeah,
or something like
them,
that.
Yeah.
The reviews on there for a while were all 100% positive, and now it's down to like 60 because. A lot of
they've
people
actually
are,
seen it now.
Well, you know, there were like 6 or 7 people at first who were original screeners, so I think they kind of let like kind of fanboy.
Yeah, that's
guys
probably what they're doing.
Watch
yeah.
it's the actual critics, and a lot of the critics are saying, you know, it's extremely beautiful, very good looking thing, but they said it's pretty much in between a war recruitment film and gay porn. That's
yeah,
two
I
movies
imagine.
Now that I've mentioned today.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
have to do with gay porn.
That seems to be a big theme with films these days, or at least interpreting it that way. You have to wonder is it the just the replete element of popular culture
yeah.
that's allowing that to happen now,
yeah,
or have movies actually started to change?
Right. You know, Chuck Klosterman. I don't know if you've heard of him, like a pop culture critic.
Yeah,
pop culture
critic.
Yeah, he once said that the only thing I ever really took of his that was seemed like a good something good he said was. That
something
critics
non-trite or you know
yeah,
non-trivial
criticism of any pop culture thing has more to say about the critic than about the medium they're talking
indeed
about.
Indeed, that
because
can be true.
You're
yeah.
getting nothing but subjective viewpoints, and there's no such thing as an objective art critic. And so the fact that we even read and honestly in newspapers, I think I saw in a poll somewhere last year that like the most popular parts of newspapers are the things that are least news-like.
Absolutely. It's all about the subject. Anyway, so back to the 300. Yeah, it does look pretty gay. Like, you know, it looks gay. It looks gayer than the pile. I mean, to quote the South Park episode. But I mean, that's kind of a truthful aspect of the way the Spartan society was, I think. Not, but I'm more interested in, I guess, in the nature of the conflict, because for my money, one of the best episodes of Samurai Jack, the cartoon show, that was on a few years ago on Cartoon Network, which was like sort of so good that it didn't fit in any of the programming blocks on Cartoon Network.
Is it done now?
Oh, they have 52 episodes, but it didn't have any closure. And now that Mako, who was in the Conan movies and who did the voice of Aku, has passed away, it's kind of like they can't really end the show, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't think anyone else can quite do his voice, and that was really key to, you know, the antagonists are usually more interesting characters, and Aku certainly was bringing the interesting there. But anyway, in the 25th episode of Samurai Jack, it was heavily influenced by the Frank Miller 300 comic. They had all been reading that, the creators of the show. And so they did an episode where Jack runs into 300 Spartans that are fighting these, like, mechanical bulls, and it's the same kind of setup where it's them constantly fighting this overwhelming force, and because of their geography, they're in a position where they can defend their place. And it was, like, the 300 plus one, and Jack was, like, the one that helped him out. And it was actually one of the best episodes because they just went widescreen once it started, and they kept it that way the whole time, so it played like an epic. And it's in the season two, it's the only one that has commentary. They're kind of they don't do enough commentary on the episodes of that show for me. In terms
What's
of
the creator's name? Patty something?
No, Gendy.
Gendy
Tartakovsky.
I was thinking of Patty Chayefsky for some reason.
No, he's a Russian fellow, and he's actually like the
he's the one who did the Star Wars.
He did the Star Wars Clone Wars, yeah. Which I was just arguing to some people yesterday, or telling him that yeah, the new movies aren't that great, but the Clone Wars is probably the coolest,
those were very good.
Coolest thing Star Wars out there.
By the fact that it was about 95% action. And,
that's what he said. I said saw an interview with him. When he knew he was going to have to do them as like 5-minute shorts or 3 minutes or whatever, he went and looked at old episodes of Samurai Jack and saw how much he could cut out to still like have a narrative through line. And between season one and season two, I think season two are little like 10-minute ones, but it's like 5 10-minute ones. It plays like a full story, but you get like a Jedi lightsaber battle in the rain, which is just the coolest thing ever. And then, Tartakovsky does stuff as an action director at animation. That's just primarily what Samurai Jack was all about. Right. He said he just wanted to see an action cartoon that was all action because he grew up in the 80s watching like Thundar and things he really digged. And Conan, that's one of his favorite shows, our favorite movies, the original. And that's what he wanted to do, is he wanted to do a lot of action.
I thought it was
stuff.
Interesting that in the kids' cartoon series that he created there were more deaths of main characters than in all the movies combined, it seemed like. The fact that they killed off so many of the Jedi that you don't see like between the second and third movies.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And they had to kind of do it in that cartoon, clever way.
But they were still obviously killing them.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought that was interesting that they played
well,
out.
Well, a lot had to happen. It was like he had to sort of establish all this stuff that's going on. And I guess they're going to do some 3D animation Clone Wars cartoon now, which I'm not too positive about, but... That's too bad.
I heard it was live action. Is it 3D?
No, they're supposed
now?
To do a live action television show that I think is supposed to take place between the third and fourth movie. This one would take place between the second and third. Yeah, it could. I mean, as a TV show, it could play really cool, but I don't know. I don't know. It might be lame.
I have a question about this whole Star Wars thing, and it has to do with any sort of franchise where there's a sole creator and a person who claims to have some sort of executive decision in terms of
what's canon and what's not.
So how about this? With Star Wars, you have George Lucas, who obviously wrote and directed the first thing. Basically,
well, he created that huge outline,
exactly,
apparently.
And he had the whole outline and everything. So how about this? How is it that there are dozens of video games, there are dozens and dozens of books, there's comic series. Does he actually personally get shown these things?
I think he does on some level. I think it's just as simple as, and I don't know where it involves in terms of like the canon and stuff, but most of the stuff... There are some books that are sort of like after the movies, and I think there's a section of books. I don't know what the guy's name was. I want to say Dan O'Brien, maybe, was the guy that wrote a few Star Wars books, and those are considered like okay. They're valid. Basically, what Lucas did is he said nothing between this period of time and this period of time in the Star Wars continuity or universe is is anyone can talk about. And that was essentially the time period that would cover the first three movies.
Basically, the stuff he wanted to do himself.
The stuff he was going to cover himself.
The thing about that is, though, he allowed people to do stuff that was set thousands of years before. And they
Knights of the Old Republic.
Exactly. And they end up mentioning a couple of characters in the third movie, actually, that were Sith Lords from those video games.
Yeah.
That were set thousands of years before, and he didn't write the storyline for those games. So I was wondering...
I think at that point he's just sort of looking at the continuity of the world that he's allowed other people to contribute to, and it's become something that then he can kind of play with and he can work within. So, I mean, you're right. The ownership of the idea certainly disappeared from being solely his, but I think that happened as soon as he brought Lawrence Kasdan in to help with Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, absolutely. It just strikes me as that would be a huge amount of things for him to approve on. I wonder if people put things in front of him and say, listen, I'm writing this book and I did this and this and this and this. Is this okay? And if he just goes, yeah, and puts a stamp on it. Or if he's like, or if he actually talks to them, I don't want this to happen because it affects something that
I
did in the movies.
I would imagine that it's all run through his company, then, I mean, there's probably like a lot of legal stuff that happens, but he's already gone through all that to sort of say, this is kind of what I envision the world of Star Wars as being okay to have, you know, so he's probably got like some kind of like cease and desist on anybody that wants to write like Star Wars porn or some kind of, you know, like some kind of Star Wars hentai manga or something.
It could make
weird
a lot of money.
I wouldn't doubt it, but it won't be canon, and it, you know,
officially mandated Star Wars.
No, it won't be that. So I mean, that is an interesting point about a sole creator. At a certain point, I think if you're accepting that you're like the showrunner on something, it all comes down to you, and that is just part of your job, and that's probably why you don't end up writing or directing every episode or something.
I wonder when a creator, like say J.J. Abrams, for instance, we already mentioned him, so he creates a show like Alias or Lost, and he actually writes the first two episodes.
And directs them.
Exactly, and they're full of pertinent information that has so much to do with the rest of the thing. And then he's gone because he's the executive producer, so he's there, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he's not there with the writers. He's off directing other movies.
Like Mission Impossible
3.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a huge...
Or the new Star Trek.
Yeah, it's a huge undertaking. He's off doing those things. He can't possibly be there looking over the shoulders of the writers of the show like Lost. So how involved... I mean, unless he sat down and he planned the entire episode,
like the
entire arc of the series, which I highly doubt he did because I've heard interviews with the writers saying... Yeah, we're just now figuring out how we're
going to
end
this.
Exactly,
but we are going to end
exactly,
it, so don't
yeah.
give up on us, right?
Exactly. So I'm wondering, is it basically just they hire writers good enough to come in and clean up the creator's junk, or does the creator actually stay involved for the whole way to guide them? This is how I want things to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just now getting finished watching Alias, and there are certainly, I've noticed things that had been brought up in earlier seasons that seem like they've kind of given up on or just kind of let go or kind of quickly solved, and that show kind of reinvents itself every season, which I got a kick out of because it has like a couple of the same core characters, but in the way it reinvents itself is like they have a new situation or something. But he's become less and less involved. I couldn't take on that myself. But I personally have no idea, and I don't know if it is a structured thing, like how involved an executive producer is on a show in order to legally be called an executive producer. Are they just the money? Is it just the name? Like, or is that person there on the set every now and again? Or in the writer meetings? I mean, from listening to the podcasts, the creator podcasts of the new Battlestar Galactica with Ron Moore, he's the show developer. So he sits in on all the writer meetings, and he does like a final pass polish on just about every script. So even if it isn't said written by him, he's probably added things to it, or he's changed things about it. So he sounds like he's very involved on the story and in the whole flow of the show. But then again, that's all he's really doing. He's not off directing other movies. I mean, he might be working on other series and stuff like that on some level. But so, I mean, I don't know on what level Abrams' involvement is or presence is really there in terms of writer meetings and stuff. He might be getting an email, correspondence. I mean, with the new technology, it can be quick. And easy, but you're right. In order to do it right, you have to sort of be there in the mix.
Considering that a certain person, in a lot of cases, a single individual creates a whole group of characters. They create the initial storyline. They create what the premise, the conflict of the show is going to be.
Yeah.
And then they're gone after that because they get to the point where an executive producer. I'm not saying that an executive producer isn't there all the time because, in fact, most of the time, an executive producer. I mean, considering the other person who is getting the royalty rights and everything.
Exactly, yeah.
They're highly involved in the show. I just wonder if they're... A lot of times the writing process is so much different from the actual production and everything else that goes on with the show that you think that these writers could spend, a week... You know, three writers spend a week hammering out or more... Hammering out. I mean, with TV shows, it's definitely less than with a feature film because.
It's less, but they've got more. Maybe they've got a couple different stories going at the same time, a couple different arcs that they really want to play through.
And even if they all sit down at a meeting like they do with South Park, I've heard what happens is, the earlier episodes were actually written by Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
They still written by Trey?
No, actually, they say that, but what they do is they sit down. They do how many episodes per season now?
They do two sections of like seven and eight.
So they sit down with their staff writers at the beginning of a season, and they say, "Listen, we know that things are going to change. For instance, sometimes they put out an episode." Remember the Terry Schiavo thing that happened?
Yeah, they did that.
They did that literally.
And they won an Emmy for that.
Exactly.
And it was a good episode.
They wrote, shot, they do that every week. They basically write the dialogue for everything.
Their turnaround on production is incredibly fast.
Yeah, they basically write the thing in a couple of days.
And that's what I've seen an interview with them on Charlie Rose where they talk about how that's the only way they can really make it work to not to keep it fresh themselves, but also to not get too bogged down in some kind of a message maybe
Absolutely.
Or whatever, where they feel like they don't want to.
Which they end up having a little fake message thing.
Have a message, but they won't start overthinking it or being like, oh no, we shouldn't do that because that doesn't really sound like appropriate to this or whatever. They just kind of have to just do it.
Right, but the thing is,
they have to commit to the bit, you know.
Right. So what they do is they sit down with these other writers and they say, we know that we're not going to be able to every week. Have something happen in the news where we can make actually a good episode out of it.
Exactly.
So what they do is they plan a whole season's worth of episodes not based on that stuff that's going to happen.
That's
based on
cool.
just based
and
on
then
just
they can go
they
can
they
go back to
exactly.
those when something's
exactly.
calm.
But in the meanwhile they have them come up with a whole storyline. They have them come up with a whole storyline. The only thing that's really I think that Trey Parker and Matt Stone really have to do now is that they have somebody basically plot things together, and then they basically make the dialogue how they want to. And I think they ad-lib somewhat during the dialogue.
I would imagine you might be able to do some degree of that. Yeah, but it's pretty much like a puppet show. It's just those two guys doing all
exactly,
the voices.
Yeah.
I remember that's what they said Mike Judge said he liked about the show. It's kind of like a puppet show.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
You two guys doing different voices.
One thing I think is interesting is that their original Christmas card thing they made was actually the cardboard cutouts, and since then it's all a computer program that makes it look really
pilot,
crappy.
The first pilot was also
was
done
it?
With construction paper, I believe.
Yeah.
And then they even did an episode of South Park where the kids were doing an animation in that style, just to sort of talk about that.
I've seen some people criticize the show for the fact that that the animation is purposefully crappy looking, that they make it purposefully awful looking.
Well, it's its own style.
It definitely is.
And they're running us like software, and I think that's part of why their production can be so fast.
So quick.
Because they're running
absolutely.
Software that they could do like much
absolutely.
More advanced stuff.
I mean, because
if
you think about it, they said they're usually doing dialogue the night before a show airs. So what does that tell you about animation? They have people animating the show in literally like 2 days.
Well, it's the same kind
all
of
you have to do is just
mouth movements
put the mouth
and stuff,
in there. Then you move a guy. I mean, there's obviously
change
not a lot
the
of detail in the hand.
Stuff, yeah,
right, right. It's a great thing. And, no one would ever plan that a show like this would actually happen. The fact that it's still alive is sometimes amazing, even though it's definitely the most popular thing on Comedy Central and so forth. But
it's I mean, I'd imagine it's kind of funny because South Park sort of rides that right of center, but more of a sort of like social libertarian
absolutely.
Sensibility, as opposed to something like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, where it kind of makes
its
bread and butter
left,
by being,
or mocking the right in all forms.
Mocking the right or mocking the politicians and being kind of a,
In that episode I was watching before the premiere last night, that the Goobacks episode with the time traveling immigrants. They had a couple of characters. The one character that kept recurring was the angry redneck guy who kept saying they took
exactly.
our jobs. And then they had this other character though, and they really, even though they kept saying redneck to try to make sure that everyone was thinking, we're making fun of both sides.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly.
The one that they really made look stupidest was the guy who they called a aging
liberal
douche.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And just by the name there, they really make it clear which one they're. And in interviews, they say, we hate Republicans, we hate liberals. I saw a football commercial. The NFL Network had a bunch of different celebrities on their commercials before the network came out. One of them was Trey Parker and Matt Stone wearing Broncos jerseys. They're huge Broncos fans.
Yeah.
And they say in the commercial,
their team.
When we were growing up in Colorado, all we had to do besides making fun of liberals was watching the Denver Broncos, and that's why we're such huge fans. And they don't even mention all. I mean, they made it very clear, this commercial. I'm not sure how many people saw the commercial, but just in this 15-second spot, they say, you know, we have been making fun of liberals our whole lives. Yeah. And it's interesting to look back at their past. They're able to get away with so much. The rampant racism on that show is astounding, absolutely astounding. And Trey Parker and Matt Stone actually got together in one of their first drama classes at whatever school they went to.
They went to the University of Colorado Boulder, I think.
That's right.
And they had a film class together. Yeah. And they decided rather than
They did
doing
this thing called Show Nuff. Have you ever heard about that?
No.
They did this in a drama class together that same semester. They had they put together a two-man play called Show Nuff that was about a 60-year-old black woman. And the whole thing was that Trey Parker played the 60-year-old black woman, and Matt Stone was different characters asking her questions.
Oh my gosh.
And they got like Fs for the class. They got kicked out of the class because it was like virulently racist, you know. And I just think it's interesting that guys like that have gotten a chance to basically become hugely successful.
I've seen a lot of stuff about South Park. The Charlie Rose interview was good, where he actually tried to get into the politics, their politics,
right.
And you know they weren't really sidestepping it, but he kind of said, so like, are you guys like a libertarians? And Trey Parker's like, that's kind of like asking somebody if they're gay. It's like maybe sometimes, kind of. You know, they did sidestep it a little, but I mean, I think they've made it pretty clear that they're kind of live and let live types. I mean, they don't. Generally like the types of people that are going to tell you how to live your life.
They seem to really hate when anyone tells anyone else what to do.
And so that's why, you know, they'll attack Rob Reiner.
Yes,
but they'll also,
for the smoking thing.
They'll also attack people that just are indecisive in making an issue out of something.
I think it's interesting
ridiculous.
That they turn on people who've helped them out, too. George Clooney was the one rumored to have helped them
exactly.
get their stuff around. And then the episode,
The smuggler episode, which was a fantastic episode.
It really was good, yeah. I think it's interesting, though, that you know, I guarantee you that someone like Clooney thinks it's funny.
I'm sure he gets a sense of humor about it on some level. But for real, but they were actually being, you could tell there was a little bit of seriousness.
Yeah,
they're like, you know, you were being smug when you said to credit.
And he probably realized
that.
He's a humorous guy. You've seen him.
Yeah, he seems like he's got a sense of humor.
And then the other hand, you have the Sean Penns of the world.
Oh, yeah, who has no sense of humor,
by
the way.
Yeah, and who send them extremely angry letters. Did you ever read that letter?
I never read the letter, but I got... Based on their whatever they said about it, it sounded like literally he was saying that they should not have freedom of speech because they could affect the election.
Yeah,
you know, Team America could make people vote for Bush, and so it shouldn't be released. which did sound like kind of a nifty little. I mean, ultimately, if you look at either side on their extremes, they're fascists because they want their side is right, all their
right.
sides are wrong, and that's always something I found a little amusement by is if someone's kind of an extreme leftist, you ultimately can just say, you know, you're being a fascist.
Yeah.